The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Rami Nashashibi. Rami is the executive director of the Inner City Muslim Action Network. He is a MacArthur Genius Grant Fellow and a 2018 Opus Prize laureate. He received a PhD in sociology from the University of Chicago and has taught courses at multiple universities since, including a teaching appointment at the Chicago Theological Seminary. He was appointed by President Barack Obama to the President's Advisory Council on Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. Rami serves on the board of the Marguerite Casey Foundation and is an advisor to a number of strategic initiatives across the country. Rami Nashashibi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
You cited a core principle of the work at the Inner City Muslim Action Network as being, quote, spiritually rooted and broadly informed, end quote. I'd like you to unpack that a bit for us, because it strikes me that you're getting at something very important and something that's connected to a phrase I love and I use all the time, which is that you need to, quote, fight like you're right and listen like you're wrong.
No, that's powerful. I like that quote. I think, in part, there is a spirit of that in the context of being spiritually rooted, which for us is also comes out of a understanding that, you know, a lot of us, particularly who are informed by various traditions. In my case, you know, at a certain point in my life, the Muslim spiritual tradition became the, you know, orienting faith that helped me align myself with other faith traditions and other communities, and was a compass for me. And the deeper I took that tradition, the more engaged I was with it, I appreciated both the depths of what it meant to be rooted in traditions, yet at the same time, and equally along the same lines, about the ability of also being as unapologetic about the way we reach from across traditions. And certainly that's how my work started here at Iman. I was, you know, both rooting myself in a certain set of experiences and at the same time drawing from a number of experiences. So, for example, you know, the Jewish American experience of organizing on the South Side, confronting that kind of liminal position of being in between various communities and trying to navigate power dynamics and be authentic to their, you know, to Jewish principles and values was something really important and provided us and me with lessons that were not only critical to thinking about how I thought about myself as an organizer, a Muslim American, Palestinian origin, South Side of Chicago organizer, but also the same kind of ways in which the Jewish community both was effective in some ways in rooting itself in some enduring Jewish spiritual traditions while being, again, broadly informed by a number of experiences. And our work and much of what we've done here at in the context of my community organizing has helped inform that approach, if you will, for the last two decades or so.
Yeah, I mean, the duality of that is so important. And I know for myself, and I'm 53 years old, I was brought up Catholic but left the church, as so many people have done. And so I became sort of very much interested and broadly informed, but there was no spiritual rooted. And I keep finding people, especially my age, with similar socioeconomic backgrounds, a bit lost and needing to find what those roots are, and but not feeling comfortable going back to necessarily the church. And so it becomes a sort of hodgepodge that you pick from, which ultimately becomes somewhat unsatisfying, I think.
Yeah, you know, the spiritual journey is an interesting one that I'm still very much on. I was not brought up with any convictions around any faith tradition. And although I had family members who were Muslim, that was certainly not what I was brought up with. And I, you know, I had a very eclectic upbringing. But, you know, at a certain point, I encounter the spiritual tradition of Islam more through, quite frankly, community activism, hip hop, and eventually a spirituality often coming out of what sometimes in Arabic is called tasawwuf, in English sometimes described as kind of the Sufi mystical traditions. And somehow in the middle of all of that, I kind of found a place and space that felt right to kind of lay down roots or attempt to lay down roots, and did not only not contradict with this idea broadly informed, but in many ways reinforced it. I mean, hip hop, for instance, if I would just think about hip hop in and of itself, it was an art form that in many ways was rooted and broadly informed. It was unapologetically rooted in the experiences of young black and brown communities in the Bronx and in Brooklyn and New York in the late 70s. And here you have an art form that in many ways rooted in experience. The hip hop culture was rooted in experience, but quickly was broadly informed by an eclectic sets of sounds and cultural experiences across the globe. And in many ways, I think that's what made it so resonant and relatable and transferable as perhaps one of the most widely proliferated art forms of the late 20th century, early 21st century. And I think that's something that has similarities and parallels, I think, also with spirituality. There are ways in which the tradition itself challenges you and calls you to think about how you relate to others. And once you open up a way to do that in a way that is authentic, I felt like for a while I didn't know how, quite frankly, to organically incorporate the experiences of other faith traditions. But I found the more I became rooted in one tradition, actually the more seamless and more organically, the incorporation of other traditions became. And so very practically, I mean, I had never really spent time in Pentecostal churches and Lakota sweat lodges and, Shabbats and, Jewish services. Yet the more I understood my own tradition or a particular tradition, in this case, the Muslim tradition, I think just the more comfortable I felt not only being in those spaces, but absorbing the beauty of those spaces for what they were and what they were attempting to express, and beginning to both appreciate similarity and difference in ways that just felt very natural and very aligned with the type of community organizing sensibility. Because in many cases, I was in those spaces not just as a spiritual searcher or seeker, if you will, but as a activist and organizer that was interested in thinking about how to connect and build with these communities around issues like criminal justice reform or housing or immigration.
I think it's interesting how one goes through life and enters into those spaces, because for me, and I think this might be for you as well, art served as such a, I would fall in love with these artists. I love jazz. I love the Grateful Dead. And I'm like, oh, they share this sort of thing around improvisation. And I studied the Beat Generation. Oh, there's improvisation there. And then I end up at Second City in the home of improvisation. You also talk about the influence of Public Enemy. And it kind of made me laugh because I loved Fear of a Black Planet. but I was digging that in the mean streets of Kenilworth, which is, you know, it's funny in its own way. But I was definitely hearing something that connected to an experience of the world that I was interested in, and that was I see an othering that I don't want to occur, because I felt othered in my world as well.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think there's something about the way in which, these particular traditions emerge in artistic expression that, at least in my case, really called me in. And some of it was eerily familiar, and some of it was absolutely outside the bounds of anything else I had experienced up until that point. Yet again, there was these really profound ways. In my case, I think part of the Muslim sensibilities that had pervaded, hip hop in the late 90s, and it really in some ways was part and parcel of the hip hop experience from the very beginning. I mean, Rakim was the first to introduce All Praises Due, which is almost a direct translation into the kind of Muslim spiritual term of Alhamdulillah. Mm. And eventually you had everyone from Wu-Tang to Lauryn Hill to, you know, Diggable Planets, the Tribe Called Quest, all these various, iconic hip-hop acts, not only incorporating this subtly into their kind of expression, but calling back and making connections to experience and movements across the globe in ways that invited you in to see yourself in there somewhere. And, again, it was the first portal also for someone like me to also reach back and even think about those threads in jazz, and to think about those threads in other musical art forms. And there was something very powerful about, that as a portal to both, again, explore the similar and to be invited in a more safe space to engage experiences that were completely outside of your point of reference.
Yeah, we just talked to George Lipsitz, who is a scholar of Black Studies, and he has a new book called Insubordinate Spaces, and it's about improvisation, but as taught as in a social justice context. And there's a great phrase in the book you need a space in which to change these spaces, that it happens in a place where people congregate and converge. And that's where the great improvisation happens, when people can work together. And there's a very much of a, he talks about Romero, Archbishop Romero, having this metaphor of walking down the road together, as opposed to looking at a hierarchy. And I talked to him about the idea in improvisation of you're very much, when you're improvising, you're walking backwards in the future, because you're using all those things that you can see, which are of the past, but you also have the peripheral vision. Yeah. And I think when we recognize that, there's an evening, and there's a connectedness, and we all need each other. I think we have to think about that. We have to change the conversation and how we talk about these things, as one pillar, to get us past just some of the terrible things that we're experiencing today, but that have experienced all the way through humanity.
Yeah, but you know what what I love about what you just described was the kind of emphasis on deliberate spaces, right? Yeah. You know, I spent a lot of time, and I continue to almost obsess about this point in our work and our organizing. We constantly think about intentionality around the type of spaces that we're forging, creating, in organizing language. We talk about, spaces that can allow us to radically reimagine the world as it could be. Mm-hmm. In theoretical terms, even my part of my dissertation, or my lead up to my dissertation, one of the chapters was kind of Mighty in the Margins, the power of these liminal marginal spaces and what they provide in terms of opportunities to kind of, again, be betwixt and between different, moments in our, and sometimes very suffocating reified identities and forces. And when you find yourself in these marginal spaces, which are often very messy, often very painful, but yet they still provide in them ways of kind of subverting some of the more dominant structures and narratives that kind of have constrained us from, you know, moving outside things like what does it mean to be white, or what does it mean to be an Arab on the South Side, or a African American kid in a particular neighborhood, when so much of the structural systemic forces have predetermined that in ways that most of us are really unconscious about. There's some powerful ways in which very creative dynamic spaces somehow they have a very powerful way of untethering you to, you know, from those forces, even if it's temporarily, to explore different possibilities and new meanings. And well, I have found that some of the most transformative work happens in very concrete ways. I know this sounds very theoretical oftentimes, but I think from a community, from a very pragmatic community organizing, community development, you know, perspective, this can have real transformative possibilities. And, you know, I think for me, the most powerful moments in my work as an organizer over the last two decades have happened in such spaces.
Well, the way you founded Iman is that in many ways, because I have a quote from you. You said, at the University of Chicago, I had the space to think about extraordinary ideas. And then I would go back to the community where sometimes those ideas seem so disconnected and irrelevant to the day in, day out struggles. I mean, you were maybe a little bit fringe in both spaces and found a way to bring them together.
Yeah, and I certainly would not have been at the University of Chicago if it wasn't for the community work that I was doing. I mean, I think I was first driven to a kind of highly academic theoretical space to try to, you know, figure out and think through some of the stuff that we were dealing with every day in the community. And yes, and sometimes being so proximate day to day to the, you know, the struggles, the challenges, the opportunities, they do diminish sometimes your ability to step back and think about the luxury of thinking about larger pictures and larger analysis. And the ability to kind of navigate between those two spaces was a privilege and a challenge, but one that has definitely informed, you know, looking back, a lot of the ways in which I strive to think about my work even today.
I want to talk a bit about the world today. You write, quote, "We still live in a country where, unfortunately, many Americans still associate Islam with violence. The recent Pew study found that almost 50% of Americans are more likely to think about Islam as a religion that promotes violence than other religions," which betrays fact in history and all that. Mm. It is very easy to be full of despair today about the world we live in. And in most of your writing and most of your speaking that I've seen, you tend to be a realist but an optimist. And I'm wondering, where is your, you know, how do you frame that for yourself? How do you walk through the world when there is so much of this just overwhelming hate that is rooted towards immigrants and towards Muslims?
Well, you know, I think part of the, optimistic realism, if you were to call it that, it really does come out of both engagement and attempt to really seriously engage these kind of spiritual mentors and teachings that I feel like I've been a real privileged beneficiary of over the years. But also, it really does come out of a real basic Chicago community organizing sensibility, which says, you know, you start at the, you know, with the world as is. Students of people like Alinsky, like Ed Chambers, it's not a coincidence that a lot of them had a theological training. And you know, so much of their language, you know, one of the courses I taught in graduate school was community organizing as spiritual practice, because there is a lot of spiritual aspirations embedded in basic community organizing ideas 101. And, you know, I think part of the appeal, I think a great part, personally, of the Obama presidency appeal came out of those spiritual ideals that were embedded in organizing sensibilities. This idea of the world as could be is a phrase that you heard Barack and Obama and Michelle Obama use multiple times. And it was this idea that, yes, we are constantly trying to reimagine aspirational ideals of what the world, our neighborhoods, our city can actually look like. And the difference between that type of creative imagining and sometimes the very naive kind of oblivious kind of sense of a ideal world is starting from the world as is, i.e. that realism. In other words, in organizing, you start in the world as is. You confront the messy reality of where we are, and you don't try to clean that up, and you embrace the messiness of it. You embrace the humanity of it. I've learned over the years, even some of the more painful parts of that, just to be very honest about when you're in those spaces, and to confront that, and to realize that that's our starting point, and to never, even although we start with that, and if we were to simply stay there, of course, that's when you get to the point where, you know, you are incapacitated from moving forward. And so if calling out, if you will, this calling, you know, sometimes this call out culture, which there's some value in it. I don't want to dismiss that. I mean, there are some very real, systematic, structural, undergirding stories that we're just coming to terms with about who we are and how we have become who we have become. You know, projects like 1619 and other projects that we're now in the thick of, maybe we may feel like this is a moment where we're getting more access to it than we ever have. But the reality is, it's because I think we've been so deprived the opportunity to have real, authentic, engaged conversations, and honest, if you will, confrontations with the narratives that have been painful in our lives that have shaped who we are. And so that's where we start. That's the world as is. That's calling that out and being honest about those things. Yet if you're not calling up to something, if you're not thinking about the world as it could be, then you're not really not only providing a meaningful map for those who you're engaging, you're not really doing much to, in fact, address the suffering. In fact, you know, in some cases, you can simply suggest, you can take away all agency and suggest that we are, you know, inescapably bounded to acquiesce to that suffering and the world as it is and never aspire towards something that is greater. And what I've seen consistently throughout the work is when you can create winnable moments that help close some of that distance. And again, community organizing is driven by the belief that you will never fully close the gap between the world as could be and the world as it is. But even if you create enough of those micro steps that close a fraction of that gap, you lift up the hopes and possibilities that we can continue to forge forward. And forging forward is, in fact, in many ways, perhaps the entire essence of it all, is that in the thick of these things, in the midst of all of our challenges, that we find ways in which we connect to one another, we become inspired by one another, we see humanity in one another, and we find ways to continue to overcome what may at certain times seem insurmountable. And, you know, again, that has very practical day-to-day implications. And, you know, I've been very privileged to see what that type of organizing, what those type of convictions can really lead to. And they've been perhaps the most responsible for, you know, animating my optimism about, you know, who I've had the privilege of working with and being around over these last, you know, two decades or so.
Yeah. I mean, this makes me think of a thing I'm going through, because I, you know, I've talked about this on the podcast because I talk about myself, but I lost my 17-year-old daughter to cancer just about 43 days ago. And I had one of my friends gave my wife a note yesterday, and it was a lovely letter. And in it, he recounted an improv colleague who said, when you hit a wall, create a door. And it was such a lovely sort of sentiment. And it's this, you know, and I've been doing so much reading and across different religions, and a lot of them are you know, you can't have, the reason we suffer is because we have the joy, and we have this duality that we're dealing with. And human beings tend to be a little uncomfortable with that ambiguity, with the ambiguity of a duality. And we like things to be good or bad and simple and understandable. And they're just not. They are messy. And so, you know, being comfortable with your discomfort really allows you, we know from an improvisational world, to bring you incredible opportunities and collaborations. But you have to practice a lot to get there.
Yeah, you know, and I, first of all, my, you know, deepest condolences to you and your wife. And I don't think any of us who have children, and certainly with my three, it is you know, the most unfathomable, yeah, you know, pain of all pains to even think about. And those of us who've lost loved ones, fathers and family members, and those of us who are, you know, proximate to people who have lost close ones, you know, I've unfortunately been to way too many funerals, yeah, in the last two decades of people that I've loved and people who, you know, much younger than me. And there's something, though, about this kind of familial proximity to it that does challenge, you know, a lot of these, you know, sometimes more easily held convictions in other circumstances. And I think it's one thing to aspire towards those ideals. It's one thing to aspire towards those convictions. And it's certainly another thing to kind of be in moments where, you know, mental meets the road, so to speak, and you're really, you're there. And I have a close friend who, 2 years ago, he's younger than me and, you know, extraordinary, articulate, well-spoken, you know, inspirational, you know, mentor to thousands across the country, a guy from California who was diagnosed with ALS. Mm-hmm. And I have seen the rapid decline. And, you know, every time I call him, see how he is wrestling with, and upon my visits, this almost unimaginable set of circumstances. And you know, next week I may be traveling with him. One of the things he's asked me for the last year, every time I talk, is Jerusalem. My father's family has a deep rooted kind of Palestinian family that goes back to the 13th century, or the 1300s rather, in Jerusalem. And he always used to speak about that with me, and it's one of the few places that he never had a chance to travel to. And we're embarking on a journey to try to make that happen. And part of it for me is, I think as I'm trying to get my mind around this journey, as I plan the details, is just being proximate to him,
yeah,
as he's going through this moment, and trying to come to terms with how people are coming to terms. He spoke very eloquently almost within the week or two of being diagnosed about facing his own mortality. And it's perhaps one of the most interesting and challenging talks I've ever heard, because he talked about how sometimes spiritual folks have a lot of, you know, very well constructed notions to somehow speak to these issues. Yet when it is you, or it is one next to you, you have to confront it in a whole new way. I think that sometimes this work, sometimes I think I feel I'm driven to it because it forces me to be in those type of uncomfortable spaces, mm-hmm, with people who are confronting challenges and conditions that in many ways I've been very privileged to be proximate to, but never have had to undergo that at that particular level. And so But I do believe that there's a type of spiritual truth and insight and perspective that only those who are in that particular moment can see. You can only see the world through a particular lens in that space. And it's not always the most comforting thing, but I know there, you know, when I hear someone like my friend talk about his insight about life right now, it certainly comes from a perspective that I don't think I've ever heard him ever articulate before, and it's animated by what he's confronting.
I was interviewed on Rainn Wilson and Reza Aslan's podcast yesterday, and they wanted to talk about my work in improvisation and spirituality, but also the stuff we've been going through. And Rainn had this Harvard study that he pulled up that they basically interviewed a bunch of Holocaust survivors, and the two traits that were intermingled were, one, a fierce, realistic understanding of what happened, a pure acknowledgement of what occurred, and a deep abiding faith and meaning in the world. And there's this idea, and I think it's in positive psychology, called post-traumatic growth. And, you know, some people respond to these things and they let them destroy them. And some people use these things to fuel their service. And I know for me, it's like that latter choice feels a lot better, and certainly feels a way to honor the spirit of Nora. And who was so, I mean, she was so excited to vote in this next election.
Wow.
And so, you know, in many ways, my wife said that she felt like she was talking to her, and Nora said that she was okay and she was busy. And Anne's immediate idea was like, oh, yeah, she's busy working on that next election, and she's going to make it work for us.
Yeah. You know, and it seems like on some level, that duality that you described that was present, for instance, in Holocaust survivors, both a realization of the darkest realities, yet an abiding faith in something greater,
mm-hmm.
May seem to some a contradiction, but I think on some level there is this really powerful understanding. There was a moment in the Muslim tradition where the close companions approached the Prophet Muhammad, and they asked him for a prayer to make in moments of sadness and depression and just when you're going through it. And he offered them a prayer that essentially in Arabic was, he said, make the prayer of Jonah. And in the Muslim tradition, the belief that Jonah, who also, not unlike, you know, what you find in the Hebrew Bible and this idea that Jonah is in the whale at the time, and you know, there's this prayer translated in Arabic as La ilaha illa anta subhanak inni kuntu min al-zalimin. And the first part of that essentially is, there is nothing but you, O God. Hmm. Ultimately, the first part of the reality is, the first part of that prayer is this kind of recognition that above and beyond every perceived reality of life, there is something that's transcendent. And, you know, whether we call that God, the Most High, Yahweh, Allah, a power above and beyond all powers, an essence above and beyond all essences, something that we're going back to, that we've come from, a realization that we're all on that journey and we will all meet that end in some capacity or the other. We will meet that end. And there are moments in our lives that allow us to see that truth and allow all other temporary, ephemeral truths to be seen for what they are, not diminished, but ephemeral. Mm-hmm. And there's something about the enduring. The other part of that interesting, if you will, spiritual invocations is what inni kuntum min al-zalimin. And it says, and surely I have been among those who have oppressed, done wrong. I have been among those who have also struggled, essentially, and maybe even oppressed my own soul along the way, or oppressed others along the way, been a petty tyrant along the way, that I have also essentially in some form or the other in my life been responsible for some of the conditions that may put me into the funk that I'm in. And I think the power there is that you have agency on some level. If you got yourself into circumstances, that there are ways in which, even in the most challenging times, that you still have some level of agency to get above and beyond that and recognize that there is some greater reality. There is something that you're aspiring towards. And I think that kind of in some ways, almost impossible optimism sometimes to wrestle with, mm-hmm. even in the especially in the face of some of the most extraordinary challenges. And for Muslims, you know, going back to the early part of your question, I think, you know, Muslim Americans have had a whole range of historical experiences that fundamentally predate, you know, and that profoundly predate 9/11. I mean, I remember Imam Muhammad Muhammad, who the son of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and perhaps is the most tragically unknown and uncelebrated American Muslim leader in American history, because, you know, but in some ways one of the most consequential, because he was perhaps in the mid-70s the single force most responsible for mass migration into kind of a universal expression of Islam, mm-hmm. among those who were, you know, trying to navigate the major shift from the nation at the time after the death of his father, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. I remember him speaking once about their early encounter with Islam post-World War II or during the World War II era, and that the term that was being used for them was Black Japs. And he described, I mean, what it meant being both Muslim and Black in a early or mid 20th century America, or at a time where Islam was almost exclusively associated with the Black Muslims and beginning to be associated with every foreign enemy possible in this time, during the time of Japanese internment. So, you know, there are parts of the American Muslim experience that have already, you know, encountered this larger, you know, challenges of race and identity in America, and have found extraordinary ways, creative ways of, again, forging forward, building community, being a source of resilience in the face of extraordinary odds, refusing to become either simple, you know, caricatures of villains or caricature of victims, and, you know, trying to assert their full humanity. And it's that, I think, legacy of American Muslim experience that for someone like me and an organization like Iman has been really pivotal in drawing from over, you know, the last 20 plus years of our work.
So I'm going to ask you in a second for a yes and story, which is how we always end the podcast. So a time in your life when you normally said no, but instead said yes and. But before we do that, you there's a phrase that finds itself in a lot of the work that you do. I saw it many times, which is fight fear, build power. I love it. But I'm pretty sure I know what it means, but I'd love you to sort of dissect a little bit. When you say that, when you have a slogan like that, talk to us about what that means for you.
Well, I mean, and we put that in active circulation, quite frankly, right after the 2016 election, and had an event that kind of we used as a hashtag that went viral that day and was trending on Twitter when we were doing a simultaneous event in Atlanta and Chicago, and have used it, you know, intermittently throughout a number of campaigns. And for us, it simply meant this, that, you know, fear is incapacitating. Fear pits us against one another. Fear is the engine, of course, that was used to, in a city like Chicago, drive white working class folks to feel that just proximity to Black folks was going to translate in not only a threat to quote-unquote their way of life, but also in very real economic terms, a loss of everything that they had worked up to at that moment. And those weren't just, you know, coincidental fears. Those were very manufactured, very deliberate, very structured, very systematic. I mean, they were You know, orchestrated by realtors who were making a killing off white working families of Polish, Irish, Lithuanian extraction who bought their first bungalows in the mm-hmm. South Side and along this beautiful boulevard on 55th Street. And just, you know, west of the Dan Ryan, and at the same time, black families who were trying to move out of the rat-infested tenement housing into just basic, decent homes were being, you know, lured by these realtors on a block. And once they moved onto one block, these same folks would then use the tactic called block, you know, busting, which would be then go to the rest of the white residents and say, your house now is probably going to be worth less than half of what you paid for it. We'll give you this amount now and call it even and give them far less of what they purchased it for not long ago. And then create, you know, three subdivisions in that home and rent each unit for something greater than the total value of the mortgage to black families that were desperate to get out of the tenement housings. And then, you know, you would have in a few years this entire block go from black to white, and all city services would leave, and, you know, industry was leaving out. And you know, thus you have the formation of the modern post-industrial ghetto, as it's called in sociology. And you know what? A lot of sociologists talk about the making of American apartheid in cities like Chicago and Detroit and Cleveland and many urban industrial cities. And that was the tale of our, you know, late 20th century evolution of inner city urban space. And it was driven by fear. And fear continues to be that animating force. And then beyond that, once you begin to pit us against one another and you begin to think about the ways in which those communities can be criminalized and have been criminalized. You think about the undocumented communities and the fear of organizing. You think about, you know, guys who've come home from long prison sentences and instead of organizing and working on the block, don't, because they don't want to be proximate to another guy who may also be coming home and then immediately be in violation of their parole and put right back into prison. Mm-hmm. That fear then in not only drives these type of circumstances, but they sustain them, because then they keep us locked away in our own little silos, afraid to get on the block, afraid to get involved, afraid to talk to our own people, right, about, hey, we can do something. We can challenge one another. We can challenge each other to be better. And all of those factors were at play. And so, you know, our response, instead of just, you know, we wanted to have a response in the post-election moment of 2016 that was very much a call to action. Mm-hmm. And fight fear was one of them. But we didn't just want to fight. We wanted to build. And we wanted to be specific about, we needed to collectively build power. And organizers define power as just the ability to act, the ability to get things done. And the best type of power to build in our communities are power that comes when we connect with one another and see that we all have a collective stake in a certain type of community assets and resources. And that takes a lot of work. And so the call really was, in many ways, to, you know, to challenge the paralysis of the moment, the sometimes overwhelming sensibility of the moment, the kind of the 30s being beat over the head by one outrageous tweet after the other, or 30-second soundbite on the news about this community, other, to challenge all those things, to fight back with all those things by, in fact, fighting back the fear that those things could potentially create, and to respond by being very deliberate about the work that is necessary to build a power that can, if you will, you know, restore a sense of hope that things can and will be better.
I love it. All right. So in improv, you know, when you're building a scene, you get nowhere by saying no, and you can't stop at yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering, in your life, did you have a moment where you were likely going to do a no but turned around and did a yes and?
Let me see. There were multiple moments like that. One that comes immediately to mind was really, you know, 4 years ago, after finishing finally, well, it was a little longer than that. I finally, you know, I did a PhD while I was doing this work. And finally, after I graduated, I was, you know, I had to confront, am I ever going to do any, you know, I always enjoyed teaching. I was always adjuncting across the city. And I was clearly not going down the same, you know, 10-year path of a lot of my colleagues at the University of Chicago. And yet at the same time, you know, the wear and tear of this community organizing work and not having the type of, you know, the leverage to write, to think, to read, all stuff that I really enjoy, was also kind of, it was tearing at me. And I knew that I would be getting offers and that I needed to pursue offers. And I just didn't know how to reconcile them with still being able to do this work full time, which I knew I would always have to do, at least at this stage. And I was invited to assume a full-time teaching position, something I had never done up to that point, at the Chicago Theological Seminary, in a seminary. And that's not necessarily, I was not trained as a theologian. Mm-hmm. I never taught in a seminary. And the offer came to me from a close, you know, a rabbi mikvah, and at the time the president, Susan Thistlewaite, and to consider this visiting professorship, this appointment for 3 years. And I wrestled with it and until I had a chance to visit and see that this was perhaps going to be the first time where I can be very explicit in the ways in which, you know, community organizing, art, faith, and form, the types of subjects that I was interested in, and have the opportunity to teach graduate students who are wrestling with these questions in very sincere and real ways. And so finally did respond with a yes, and the and was, you still give me the autonomy, the freedom, the latitude to maintain my full-time commitments as executive director of the Inner City Muslim Action Network, and you accept me as a whole package. And I'm very grateful that the Chicago Theological Seminary gave me that moment and did allow me to both be on faculty for that period of time, which was an extraordinarily rewarding experience, a very instructive one and humbling one, an opportunity to really learn about the great, great contributions of extraordinary theologians in this country, and also do so while I had a chance to still maintain and grow and the nonprofit Iman, Inner City Muslim Action Network, that I was leading.
I love that. I got a call from my son today. He's a senior at Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs, and he was wrestling with an issue, and he was looking for advice. And you know, as we were sort of talking it through, you know, I said to him, I'm like, you know what, I think there's a yes, and there's a yes and inside the situation. Ask for what you want. Get clarity on what the opportunity is, and don't be afraid to ask for what you want, because often, you know, we're the ones who get in our own way and assume the no, or assume the yes, but there often there's, you know, people will respond and go, yeah, okay, we can do that. And so I'm hoping that turns out as a similar case for him.
Yeah, you know, and it is powerful, actually. I've been on the receiving side of that, and, you know, I've hired and had to let go of a lot of people over the last 20 years, but, you know, sometimes the real jewels among all of those kind of moments have been the people who've said, listen, with great humility, here's what I love about this ability, you know, this opportunity. And here's what I would love to bring to it if you give me this latitude. And if there is power in that, there's creative imagination in that, there's a kind of, I think, And unless you've been invited at least once or twice to kind of go down that road, I think most of us are reluctant because, like you said, we don't even know that that option exists or haven't had the invitation to try it. But once you realize that there is a power in it and that, in fact, there are more people interested in, hey, I know that's what the job description says, but guess what? You know, hell with the job description is, you know, we're interested in you as a human being and what you bring and what can you commit to and what, how do you see yourself being accountable to a set of contributions? And I think when you're in that position, you have much more latitude than you typically think you have.
Rami Nashashibi, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. It was an honor.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is LF Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive.